Good evening. This is Dr. Nalini Chilko. Welcome to our live Grand Rounds call for the Foundations of Integrative Oncology course. This call will last approximately an hour and 15 minutes. We'll start with a clinical pearl and then move on to case studies or questions from you. Please be mindful if you talk about your patients to keep their information confidential, and anything that would identify them would be redacted on any records or conversations we have. For your reference, you're currently muted, but please feel free to press *7 and unmute your line if you have a question or a comment or you want to add to the discussion. I do pause and give space for people to chime in if you have something to say or ask as I go along through the sections of the course. And so we'll get started. And just remember, you press *7 if you want to unmute yourself and speak. So there's a whole bunch of new people here tonight. We have had a lot of new people join the course, so welcome everybody. I want to remind you that you can submit a case for my evaluation and for review through the website on the Grand Rounds page, and you can also submit questions. We had two people submit things yesterday, and I need more time to review it. And so shoot for 2 weeks to 10 weeks to 10 days ahead of the call. And if you submit a case, there's a form that you fill out, and then you also have to present your proposed treatment plan. Without that, I won't review the case. So do the work of trying to figure out what you're going to do for your patient, and then I will hold your hand and walk you through it and help you to fill in the gaps in your treatment plan, and we'll talk about it in depth that way. So the first thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to teach a clinical pearl on modified citrus pectin and galectin 3, and then I'm actually going to read a letter that I wrote to a patient who is a medical doctor with stage 4 cancer and liver metastases. And then we have some questions. There was not a case submitted until yesterday, so that's why I'm going to take time to read this letter, which I think will be of high value. So let me jump in to the clinical pearl for this evening. A lot of this information comes from my friend and colleague, Dr. Isaac Elias, who is one of the main researchers on modified citrus pectin, and he actually holds a patent on this very small molecule that is the therapeutic version of the citrus pectin. And the reason it's important is because modified citrus pectin has an impact on the activity and binding of a molecule called galectin 3, which I will explain shortly. And the importance of this and why I want to talk about it is because I use modified citrus pectin a lot in my treatment plans. So the reason for that is that it regulates tumorigenesis, has an impact on metastasis and on inflammation and on fibrosis and on immune response. And so it's very powerful. It's not toxic. And comes in powder and capsules. So let's talk about galectin 3, and then you'll know why we want to inhibit galectin 3 by using modified citrus pectin in our treatment plans. I think of it mostly for people with advanced disease who we want to stop metastasis, or people who are recovered from cancer and we want to inhibit any recurrence and progression. So galectin 3 is a molecule that can be elevated in the serum in a number of syndromes, and it's linked to the development of several cancers and very strongly linked to metastatic physiology. And so that's why it's important. So it inhibits metastasis and also inhibits invasion into the extracellular space. And it can also inhibit some of the cell transformation of tumor cells that allows them to proliferate and grow. And so if we want to keep, let's say, a stage 3 cancer patient from progressing to a stage 4, you can think about using this. I also use it around surgery when there's more chance for angiogenesis and for tumor cells to be liberated from the incision area. And it also, galectin-3, you can measure it in the blood, and I'm going to talk about that. It has a potential for prognostic evaluation so that you can see if someone's higher risk. And then if you give them modified cisplatin, you can see it go down. You can see if your intervention is working. So galectin-3 is a biomarker for us, and it would indicate high risk if it is elevated. And typically, the elevations in galectin-3 will correlate in a linear fashion with multiple other elevated risk factors like angiogenesis or inflammation or blood clotting, things that are part of this tumor microenvironment. And so it's a molecule that has multiple effects. Now, it is basically a sticky molecule that binds to tumor cells, and it thereby will change the surface of the tumor cell and impact metastasis, inflammation, and fibrosis. And it also is elevated not only in cancer, it's also elevated in cardiovascular disease, particularly with congestive heart failure and also when there's endothelial dysfunction. So think sticky when you think about the endothelium, the lining of a blood vessel. It's also elevated in diabetes and chronic hepatitis, chronic kidney disease. So it's a sign of advanced dysfunctional physiology, basically. In terms of cancer specifically, it can bind to and promote the activity of growth factors such as epidermal growth factor receptor and also VEGF, vascular endothelial growth factor, which promotes angiogenesis and metastasis. It will also activate some oncogenes by binding to them and changing their conformation. And so it really is a growth signal and a metastasis signal. And it also impacts cell adhesion. So remember, it's kind of it's sticky. And it will impact the aggregation of cancer cells so that they can hold together and stick together, which makes it harder to treat them and harder to get our good herbal medicines to their cell surface or any other therapeutic agents that the oncologist might be giving them. And so when we use modified cisplatin, then we get rid of these factors. Oh, Brandon just said my papers are rustling, so I'll stop rustling my papers. Okay, thanks, Brandon. All right, so we want to be able to test the galectin-3 levels. You don't need to fast for this. It's not impacted by blood sugar, insulin, or food, the physiology of digestion postprandial. So you don't have to have the patient fast. I like to monitor every 3 to 6 months. I do like to get a baseline right at the beginning when a patient is a new patient. It helps me assess the complexity and stage and aggressiveness of their cancer. And so I like to definitely do it at a baseline. You can order a galectin-3 level from LabCorp. Quest Diagnostics does not do it. And so I always order it from LabCorp, which is a national clinical lab. Now, if you find that galectin-3 is over 17.8 nanograms per milliliter, there's actually a high risk of mortality. That's considered an extremely high level, like between 17 and 20. Your goal is to have the patient be below 12.0, ideally. And you'll see in patients who have cardiovascular disease and cancer that it's rarely below 12. But let's say you have someone who is diagnosed with a high stage of cancer, but their galectin-3 isn't elevated, then that's a better prognosis than if it is elevated with advanced disease. And when a patient doesn't have any tumor burden and no evidence of disease, then your goal can be a little more relaxed of below 14. So those would be your therapeutic goals. If somebody has cancer or cardiovascular disease, below 12. And if they don't have high risk, then below 14. Okay. So in terms of modified citrus pectin and cancer cells, the modified citrus pectin basically keeps the galectin-3 from being able to bind to receptors on cell surfaces. And that's how it works. And the modified citrus pectin is a very tiny little molecule. And so by binding to the galectin-3, then you don't have all these effects of tumor cell aggregation and the galectin-3 docking onto a tumor cell and thereby blocking some of the immune responses and turning on some of the growth signaling and pro-metastatic signaling. If you are wanting to dose the modified citrus pectin, it comes in a powder. It's a very fine powder. It doesn't have a strong taste. One company makes it in a lime flavor, but I give most people unflavored everything because people have different tastes and your tastes change when you're on chemotherapy or sick. And so I'll just use the unflavored. So a 5-gram dose is about a level teaspoon. And so if someone's blood levels are below 12 to 14, then 5 grams a day is a nice maintenance dose, even for a healthy person. If you have a blood level somewhere between 14 to 17, then 10 to 15 grams a day. So that'd be 2 to 3 level teaspoons a day. And if someone has active, aggressive, advanced stage disease, then you can go up to over 15 grams, 20 grams is a lot of citrus pectin. You do have to take it away from food and away from supplements because pectin is a binding agent and it will bind to nutrients as well. And so we don't want that to happen. But because it's a binding agent, it also can be used in detoxification programs. It does bind to some heavy metals as well. So be mindful that you instruct your patients very clearly that they want to take their citrus pectin away from supplements and meals by about half an hour. You know, think that the stomach has emptied and they've had a little time between taking something nutritive and taking the pectin. It is best taken as a powder, in my opinion, because otherwise it's quite a lot of pills, and we're already asking our patients to take a lot of pills. And if you dissolve it in something, some hot water, it dissolves much more quickly. And then they can cool it down or mix juice or something else they like with it. But most people just mix it in warm water, dissolve it, and then drink it. In a very small number of patients, it will cause bloating and diarrhea because it is a soluble fiber, and that means it's mildly fermentable fiber. So in some patients, depending on their microbiome. So in that case, then you would just lower the dose to see if they can tolerate it at a lower dose or treat their microbiome and see if you can get more balance there. It also is high in sodium. So if you have a sodium sensitive patient or a patient with hypertension that is sodium sensitive, then you would want to be mindful of that as well. There's also, along with modified citrus pectin, there is also the basil family. It's Osimum is the Latin name, O-C-I-M-U-M, and this, many species of basil. That's in the mint sage family, Labiatae. But different basil plants all over the world have the capacity to also inhibit galectin-3. So not only modified citrus pectin, and I actually found a paper on that that I've included for you. And so the basil also has the capacity to prevent angiogenesis and inhibit matrix metalloproteinases, which are the enzymes that will eat into the extracellular matrix and into the capillary walls and allow tumor cells to invade and then eventually to migrate inside of the blood vessel and travel to another part of the body. So to summarize, galectin-3 has an influence on many biological processes, but particularly with cancer development and progression, it will impact cell adhesion. Remember the sticky nature of it. It causes tumors to be able to stick together efficiently. It promotes proliferation because it interacts with growth factors. It has an impact on cell cycle progression, again, because it has a growth signaling, promoting quality. Because it covers and sticks to the outside of tumor cells, it will promote immune evasion. The immune system won't be able to see the tumor cell. It's a pro-inflammatory, pro-angiogenic molecule, basically. And so when we use modified citrus pectin, it binds to the galectin 3 and then it inhibits it from binding at its other places, basically. And so it's very, very, very safe. The only caveat is that you don't want it to be given with something nutritive or with a medication because it will bind to that. So I'm going to pause, and if anyone wants to hit star 7 and ask a question, then please do so. Okay. I want to bring your attention. Sometimes I'll also come across a great article, and I just came across a recently published 2017 paper called Cancer-Related Cognitive Impairment in Adult Cancer Survivors, a review of the literature. And my current area of research and study for the last 6 months has been in cancer-related cognitive impairment, which is why I came across this paper. And this paper is not a long or detailed paper. It points out that there are several main reasons for cognitive impairment, main categories, one being neurotoxicity, the neurotoxicity both of cancer treatments, such as chemotherapy agents, but also environmental impacts, as well as the direct toxicity of tumor cells as well. And that is combined with the contribution of immune dysregulation and high levels of inflammatory cytokines that actually can cross the blood-brain barrier and then produce a disruption in the neurons and also produce damage to the neurons, and not only their binding and neurotransmitter activity, but literal damage, and the brain can be just flooded with inflammatory cytokines. And so that is another cause of cognitive impairment in cancer patients and survivors. And then, of course, genetics. There are patients who will be more susceptible. But one of the interesting things is that cancer itself produces cognitive impairment. I used to think it was just the toxicity of the cancer treatment, but it turns out that cancer itself produces matrix metalloproteinases, which will cause a disruption in the blood-brain barrier, and then you have a leaky blood-brain barrier the same way you have a leaky gut. And so this paper is valuable because it has a lot of current references on it. And that's really, I think, its biggest value. It's not a brilliant paper otherwise, except that it collated a lot of really good research into one bibliography at the end of the paper. And I feel that this is important because cognitive impairment is experienced by over 70% of all cancer patients. And many cancer patients, even before treatment at the time of diagnosis, will have cognitive impairment from the inflammatory invasive nature of the disease itself. And so this is important. It really affects mostly the hippocampus, and that's where memory happens. Primarily, it also affects the prefrontal cortex, so it does affect cognitive and executive functions as well. But there are actually anatomical changes in the hippocampus. So this year, a lot of my lectures are going to be about cognitive impairment. And if this is an area of interest to you, then this is a paper with a lot of references that would point you in the direction to some really good and more recent studies. Okay. Did anyone want to ask anything about that or comment about that? I'll pause here. Okay. I'm going to read this letter that I wrote to my stage 4 colorectal cancer patient with liver metastases, who is a medical doctor herself and who is married to an oncologist. And it was her husband, the oncologist, that brought her to me as a patient. And he's a very beautiful man, and he realizes the limits of what oncology could do for his wife. And so I got an email very recently from him saying, she's having trouble taking all the pills. Could we just cut the doses down? So this is what I wrote. I said, it's my honor to be a resource and a support to you. I understand that as medical doctors, the idea of taking handfuls of pills is not within your usual framework. You consulted me as a stage 4 cancer patient with liver metastases. I see my role as one of supporting you in living with cancer as a chronic illness to create a tumor microenvironment that is not hospitable to, but rather inhibitive of progression and proliferation. Towards that end, I have provided you with recommendations for nutraceuticals, botanicals, phytochemicals, functional foods, and dietary and lifestyle interventions. As a stage 4 patient, it's imperative that you continue to take control of the tumor microenvironment. Take control over the remaining resistant cells and tumor stem cells that we know are there, that we know remain at a microscopic level, and we want to keep your disease microscopic, not allow it to become macroscopic again. Unlike pharmaceuticals, molecules from nature have significant mass, and they take up a lot of space, and they can't be shrunk into a few small, compact pills. So a molecule of magnesium or curcumin is big. It takes up a certain amount of space, hence the handful of pills. We have to achieve therapeutic dose ranges in order to really exert control over disease progression and over the tumor microenvironment. Now, your husband says she's having a difficult time taking 35 to 40 supplements per your protocol. Compliance is becoming an issue. It's difficult. And I say, well, what's more difficult? To have active, progressive, terminal, lethal disease? To lose your liver function? To develop obstructive disease or take a few handfuls of pills every day? There's no easy path when you're a stage 4 patient. You will always have something difficult to face every single day. I would rather the difficult task you face is taking your pills, not having liver failure, not having ascites or obstruction or cachexia develop. I cannot recommend that you decrease your doses. It's my experience that the most highly compliant and engaged patients are the ones that remain the outliers and outside the bell curve of expected prognosis. If you're halfway compliant or halfway engaged, you can't expect to be an outlier. It takes a significant amount of work and effort to cause health, to alter gene expression and function. It does not happen without effort. It takes even more to oppose the virulence of tumor cells, especially metastatic cells. It's work. It's not easy. In my opinion, it's very much worth it. But those are my values and my personal choice. It's a very personal choice and decision how you care for yourself and what you choose to do or not do to take control of your cancer. It is a significant shift in paradigm to change from a disease and pathology-focused model to a health-focused model for a medical doctor. This is especially challenging. And generally, as you know, medical doctors are the least compliant patients. So I'm trying to give you a good kick in the butt right now. You can put the supplements that you don't like, that don't taste bitter, into your shake. You can have half a shake in the morning, half a shake in the evening, and mix your supplements into those, having less pills to swallow that way. I have children who take all their supplements the way I prescribe them, so surely you could do this. Now, if you spread out your dosing over the day, you also maintain more stable blood levels. So that is a viable way to accomplish taking your pills. You can take a few every couple hours, and they just all have to be gone by the end of the day. Don't put all of your pills into one big shake, because then you'll just have extension of urine and nausea. Now, I suggest if you're having trouble taking big handfuls that you just break it up, and every hour or every other hour, take a few, and by the end of the day, they'll all be gone. Remember that what we're doing is exerting epigenetic effects, signaling gene expression. That's why it matters. That's why it matters what you eat. And that's why it matters that you continue to ingest all of those signaling molecules in your supplements. Integrative cancer care is about a handful of supplements several times a day. You can't achieve control at lower doses. There's no way around it. So as you know, this is a marathon. It's not a sprint. It's my wish that you enjoy a really good quality of life and that your disease stabilizes. You have no evidence of disease right now. You've been through several rounds of chemotherapy and surgery. We don't want your disease to progress. If you want to discuss this, let me know. We can schedule a chat so I can give you a pep talk. I hope that I will inspire you to shift frameworks and shift your relationship to pills. These pills are your allies. These pills are not pharmaceuticals with adverse effects. So that's how I talk to my patients. I'm really not negotiable. If I think there's a therapeutic dose that they really have to take, then I insist that they do that and try to help them to find ways to do so. Again, here I will take a break and take a breath and a sip of water if anyone wants to comment or chime in.
Dr. Chilkoff, Can you hear me?
I can. Who is this?
Oh, great. This is Cameron Keith.
Hi.
Hi. I had actually submitted a case study with a question kind of along these lines of over a week ago. I'm guessing that did not come through.
We did not see it. Do you want to just say a little about it? We have time. If you want to say a little
Well, I'll probably resubmit it because there was a few levels to it that I was hoping to get feedback, but one of them was actually that she's 60 years old and had a stage 1 breast cancer, and I have her on a protocol. And a couple of the pills are an adaptogen and an anti-inflammatory. And she's only taking 2 tablets of each in the morning, and it's causing actually to the point of vomiting.
Oh.
So, how do you kind of work with someone? I mean, I realize there's probably a lot of different levels to this question, but if somebody is attempting to take their pills and even 2 capsules is causing severe nausea to the point of vomiting.
Well, something else is going on there.
Yeah.
Maybe she has a sphincter that, well, we're getting a little feedback. Do you have a speaker?
I know. I'm not on speaker. Oh, let me mute myself.
Can you mute yourself while I'm chatting then?
Yeah, let me do that.
Okay. So if someone's taking a tiny amount of pills and they are having not immediate nausea and vomiting, or even, you know, a few minutes later, something else is going on. So maybe she's got an impatient cardiac sphincter and she just can't have very much in her stomach at once, but clearly she would have similar problems if she was eating too much food at once. She may be anxious or tightening up her diaphragm when she's taking the pills. But adaptogens aren't toxic or allergic in most people, and anti-inflammatory botanicals do not typically cause that symptom. So, I would, number one, stop. Don't force her to take them and try to problem solve this, because something else is going on. It's not the pills themselves. The pills are either aggravating a situation that's already there and not identified, or there's something emotional going on. And so I would look in those places first. The other thing you could try having her do is open up the pills and mix them into something like nut butter or yogurt or a thick juice or a shake, and see if they're more dilute when they hit her stomach, if they're more in a food-like form, that she could tolerate them. And also, of course, make sure she's taking them with food in her stomach. I would, get a good history about her upper GI status. You know, she have a history of esophagitis or gastroesophageal reflux or other episodes of regurgitation or vomiting and nausea in response to any groups of foods in her history, but that's a rare thing in my practice over all these years and all the amounts of pills that I give to people. But you have to look at the individual. That person is having something going on, even though it's not typical. It's real and it has to be dealt with. So, you know, you don't want to make a person worse or have them have an aversion to the next thing you're going to ask them to do. So you, I would stop them and try to figure it out and try to give her more food-like remedies in the meantime. You could unmute yourself if you want to talk.
Great. Hopefully this won't give a lot of feedback. Thank you. Yeah, I've tried to problem solve some of those things, and I think that's part of the barrier. She does have this chronic kind of mid stomach pain after she eats sometimes that she's been scoped for and had since she was a kid, and they can't really figure it out. So I think I hit a bit of a wall with that, but we're trying to look at maybe changing over to powders and tinctures and different things that may be a little better to digest. And
yeah, and I would do that.
Okay.
But the other thing is, you know, in conventional gastroenterology, they just look for hyperacidity, but some people are ahydrochloric, have achlorhydria, and that makes them uncomfortable. So you could work with a gastroenterologist and see if you could check the pH of her stomach, because there's that. I had a patient who took a lot of steroids for a long time, and she had a severe autoimmune disease, and it eroded the lining of her stomach, and she couldn't eat anything. And so we just had spent a long time trying to rebuild her stomach lining.
Okay.
So
well,
I'd go back and read, you know, I'd read the the scope reports from the gastroenterologist and see what he or she saw when they looked in there, or even get the pictures and see what it looks like, because that's not normal. And from a kid, from the time she was a kid. So
yeah, she hasn't been scoped, I don't think, for a while.
Yeah, but, you know, since she was a kid, maybe she was abused, you know? Who knows? She developed some kind of psychosomatic thing.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. And I'll resubmit the case because I wanted to make sure, because she's the first person I've worked with. So I wanted to just kind of get some feedback on
the main
plan.
Thing is, you don't want someone to not want to come see you again. So
yeah, luckily she's a friend, so we backed off a lot of the pills, and she's my guinea pig. But so we've backed off quite a bit. But it just that was went in line with the letter you just submitted, and so I was just curious, you know, if that was something you run across often, as people who physically can't take the pills, like they just become physically ill from too many pills.
No, most people do just fine. In my experience. And the people who have more sensitive upper GI systems, I just have them spread it out. I tell them, put all your morning pills in a bowl and walk by the bowl every hour and take a few.
Okay.
And then do the same thing the second half of the day. And the goal is, on the protocol I gave you, that all your pills are gone by the end of the day. I want to achieve certain dose ranges over a day. And so if you think about botanicals and nutraceuticals, we can make them more food-like for people. Like, that's what I do with kids. I have them, the moms open up the powders and mix it into nut butter with cinnamon and ginger, which are digestives. And with kids, maybe something a little sweet, so they'll take it. And that's what I do. And in China, historically, they would make little balls out of herbs and food and swallow them that way before there were capsulating machines, you know. So, you know, I would make it more food-like and maybe do something that would rebuild her stomach lining and give her something that would be soothing to the stomach and see what happens. Because if she has the same symptom with something that is not irritating to the stomach, with certainty, then someone else is going on.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Did you have any other questions about her case?
Well, I'll just probably resubmit it.
Okay.
One of the other things that she was experiencing is she was on a Rimadex. And she's very good at exercising, eating right, watching what she eats. She's doing acupuncture, but she experienced, you know, the pretty severe joint pain, mood changes, the gamut.
Yeah.
And so they've changed her to eczema stain. And I just didn't know, for people, is there anything more supportive for people who are already, you know, weight gain, muscle aches, but that are already exercising, they're already eating right, they're already doing acupuncture? Is there much more we can...
You know what? I'm going to, I'll do a clinical pearl on how to manage the side effects of aromatase inhibitors. I mean, I will answer your question, but let me answer it briefly. But I'm just making a note to myself here to do that. So there is quite a lot one can do. And, you know, realize it's like putting someone into more extreme menopause if they were already in menopause. Because, you know, our tissue makes estrogen even after our ovaries retire. And so when you take away the tissue's ability to make estrogen, which is what aromatase inhibitors do, they are given to estrogen receptor positive cancer patients to stop the aromatase enzyme from transforming androgens in the tissue into estrogen. And so thereby taking away a growth signal, the estrogen growth signal. Tumor cells that have estrogen receptors tend to have a lot of estrogen receptors. So if you take estrogen out of the environment, the receptors start to go away. And so it's a way to starve out the tumor cells of one of their main growth signals. And you know, I can do a clinical pearl on the pros and cons of aromatase inhibition therapy, but because there are estrogen receptors in tendons and ligaments, all postmenopausal women know that they are less flexible when they have less estrogen in their bodies, and it's just really extreme on the aromatase inhibitors. And so there are studies showing that vitamin D is very helpful, keeping blood levels of vitamin D optimized between 50 and 80. I like to push them up to 75. And then, and the only way you know how to dose somebody is by measuring their blood, because people utilize vitamin D at different rates. The other actual, there's a number of studies that show that simply doing more stretching, right, making the joints more elastic by doing more stretching actually helps a lot. And there are a couple of formal studies done with Tai Chi and yoga that I have in my lecture on this topic. And so a lot of people omit stretching from their exercise. And so it might be they need to be taught how to really stretch, because if that's the problem, that there's less elasticity, so the mechanics of the joint is altered because there isn't as much fluidity, then I just start with those two things. Make sure the person's eating an anti-inflammatory diet, number one. Make sure they're well hydrated so that the cartilage and the connective tissue is plump, and that they are doing a really good stretching routine. And also find that, you know, the anti-inflammatory things we already include in our protocols must, you know, make sure they're taking them at a therapeutic dose, like the omegas, the omega-3 fatty acids and curcumin, for example. So those are things that could be taken in liquid form and or a liposomal form. And so those are the things I start with. Acupuncture is helpful to some people. Of course, as someone's overweight, they're going to have more joint pain anyway. So I think flexibility, focusing on stretching, and I like things that aren't in a bottle, that aren't a pill. So if we can not have to have a pill for everything, because that's how allopathic medicine thinks, but there are actually lifestyle and behavioral habits that actually could have a huge impact more than any pill we could come up with. So that's where I start. And tamoxifen is a whole nother thing. And so I can do a little clinical pearl on this subject, but I think that's probably enough to try and help your friend for the moment.
Thank you. That helps. Yeah, because my background is I'm an oncology nurse and currently a breast cancer navigator. And I think the biggest fear that women have starting it is the weight gain. And most of the docs that I work with just tell them to keep exercising more and eating less. And they're doing that. And it's just extremely frustrating.
Well, no, doctors, male doctors don't get it.
No, they don't. And
yeah, so you're in a different body. So, yeah. Though you have to think about low impact exercise. So a doctor goes, mm-hmm. oh, exercise more. And then somebody goes and runs and does something stressful to right. their joints, right? So I'm a big fan of high intensity interval training, which you can do on the stepper or a elliptical machine. And high intensity interval training is actually one of the best ways to kick up your metabolism so that you burn more fat and build more muscle. And so keeping that lean body mass is really important. So if the joints are too painful to lift weights, then you can use bands, or yoga is a way to use your body as the weight. So I am a big fan of yoga. You can do it till you're 90. You just have to keep modifying the practice according to your body history. But that is also good for the anxiety that comes with all of this. So my bias is there, but it's my experience that most people omit stretching from their workouts. So that's for the pain of the joints. But in order to not have a lot of weight gain, you have to keep your muscle mass up. So you have to do something weight bearing. And then endurance cardiovascular exercise does not change your weight except when you're doing the exercise. So high intensity interval training is the most effective way for older people in general, but particularly menopausal women, to burn fat and build muscle.
Awesome. Thank you. This is very helpful.
The other thing I tell people is with the high intensity interval training is you have to accumulate 20 minutes a day, but you can do it in 2 10-minute sets, you know, just so it's like not something you can say no to, really. Doesn't take up a lot of time. I have executives, like some of my CEOs, I have them put a stepper next to their desk in their office and get on it twice for 10 minutes during the day in their suit, because you don't really sweat a lot if you just do a 10-minute set. So, you know, for somebody that might have a job where they sit all the time, and they can go out and do a walk for 10 minutes and push it. Or when I travel, I'll use the stairwell in a hotel and do high intensity interval. I'll jam up the stairs and then I'll walk down and I'll jam up and then I'll walk down. If there's no hills around or it's snowing or something, I'll do that. So it's, you can do it anywhere.
Perfect. Thank you again.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Anybody else want to ask a question? I have questions from Judy, which I'll address. But is there anyone else that wanted to either comment on this letter that I wrote or ask anything else at the moment?
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Dr. Stolkoff.
Yes.
Hi, this is Aniko Langell.
Hi.
And I really appreciate you reading that letter. It pulls together a lot of great thinking and, you know, ethical persuasion to help keep people on track. Is there any way you could share that with us? Obviously,
Are you new to the course?
Yes.
Everything gets posted. We have a resource library. So the slides that go with my little Galactin Clinical Pearl will be posted, along with a summary sheet with the references to that mini lecture. The letter will be posted, the reference to this cancer-related cognitive impairment. Everything that happens in this call gets put into an uploadable form, including a recording of this talk, so that if you can't attend, you can still hear it. And if you had a question in a month you can't be on the call, you can still submit the question and hear the answer to it. So you get everything.
Wow, that's fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Yeah, I think it's really important to be non-negotiable on the things that are really important to the survival and really optimized quality of life for our patients. A lot of people don't know how hard it is to cause health because it hasn't been their paradigm or their lifestyle. So these are two medical doctors who are, I guess they're in their 60s. I think she's close to 70 and he's in his late 60s, I think, and they're of Indian origin, so they're already interested in yoga and meditation. Culturally, that's been part of their life, but they weren't doing it. And so she's also a diabetic, And I got her to really take control of her blood sugar and get her hemoglobin A1C down, because in conventional medicine, of which they are a part, a hemoglobin A1C of a 5.7 is completely acceptable. And hers was over 6. I can't remember what it was. But she's a 5.4 now, and she's lost a lot of weight. So that risk factor for cancer progression is lower, having better glycemic control, less insulinemia, less hyperglycemia, less inflammation from body fat, et cetera. So I'm pretty tough, and because of that, people will self-select themselves out of my practice. But I would say that it's why I have a high success rate, because I'm not interested in negotiating things that are really important. And I had a patient, for example, that came to me who wasn't a cancer patient. She's a young woman. I treat her mom. And this young woman had a year of one antibiotic after another for ear, nose, and throat infections. And obviously the doctor didn't know what else to do except keep giving her antibiotics, and she still had serial infections. So she came to see me, and I told her the changes in her lifestyle and diet that I wanted her to make. And she wasn't willing to do it. She was trying to negotiate with me. And I looked her right in the eye and I said, come back when you want to do it, because this is not negotiable. I will tell you what works and you need to do it. You can't do it halfway. And I say that to cancer patients also. Like when someone says, oh, it's too hard to take my pills. And I'll just go, well, I think cancer is harder. You know, so I can't have a cookie, and I don't go, cookie, cancer. I mean, people have to get real. It's not negotiable at some point, and you have to be all in. You have to be in alignment with this. And so sometimes the work is internal for patients to look at their self-care, their relationship to themselves. When you get a disease that is frightening and you have to go through really difficult therapies and you're facing mortality, all your neuroses are in your face. And so it's an opportunity to grow and to heal and to transform. And I have a sign in my office that says, you are in a no whining zone. And I just look people right in the eye and I just say, you're too old for this. There's no whining in this office. And you need to do something hard here because you have cancer. And so the patients that are not resistant, they're just all fully engaged, have the extraordinary outcomes. And I want my patients to do well. So I'm very real with them. And I just say, this is what it takes. My experience is with a patient like with your diagnosis and your predicament is this is what it takes to get the goal you told me you want. And I will help you. And I also have a wonderful coach in my practice who is a functional nutritionist and behavior and lifestyle coach. And she's brilliant and patients love her. And when patients are having a hard time, they have somebody to hold their hand, which I don't have time to do, and really deal with the lifestyle changes that are very hard to do. And I tell my patients, I know I'm asking you to do hard things. And then I say, the patients that do the best do every hard thing I ask them to do with no resistance. They just do it. And so then I'll also say, just humor me. Humor me for 3 months. Do the experiment and tell me at the end of 3 months how you feel and how we're doing. And so those are some of the language, but I'm tough, you know, a tough love kind of approach, because this is serious and we don't have time to mess around. I have a couple of patients who are psychoanalysts from the School of Long-Term Psychotherapy, which I have no negative opinions about, but my experience of these patients is they want to take 20 years to work it all out. And you know, they have 2 months, you know? So I think we have to help people understand what's really happening and what they could actually do to turn it in a different direction. And so there's nothing easy about it. And I don't sugarcoat that. And I then have them have coaching and support to have someone help them really understand what they need to do, how to get their pills organized, how to change their diet, how to get more sleep, how to deal with stress and with more resilience. And people need a lot of hand-holding. And so as soon as I had a coach in my practice, especially someone so skilled, I felt like my patients were getting so much better care and having an easier time when they hit their own wall like this. So, you know, I'm a person that I deal with my stuff. And so I am standing in the room as a person like that when I'm talking to a patient. So I get to say that. So you can only take people across the bridges you have walked across yourself when you're trying to help them. So, you know, everyone has a different style, but I really, really expect people to grow. And I tell them that healing is about change. And if they're not willing to change, they're not going to heal. And so I walk people right up to the edge and say, you know, jump. And so, you know, some people are slow to do that. Some people are very quick to do it. Some of that's character logic. But that's, I feel what we have to give is really valuable. And if they actually do it, though, something will change. And then you don't have to say anything. It's completely self-reinforcing at that point. So that's my opinion on that. And I'm going to just stop here because Judy had four questions. And Judy asks questions every single time. And she asks the best questions. And even if, although she submitted them yesterday, I didn't have time to do a lot of detailed work. And I'm just going to talk about it over the top of my head here so that you get your answers. And then if we need to take a deeper dive, we will. So question number one is, you talked about having red blood cell levels checked for magnesium. Are Genova and Doctor's Data Labs the only labs to order such? Could a patient order that through any of the conventional labs? Would you please give a list of other such minerals, like iron, vitamin D, et cetera, that we should not be testing through conventional labs? So let's just get clear that the functional medicine labs do a lot of specialty tests that are not done in routine medicine, but that doesn't mean you can't order them from Quest and LabCorp just because they aren't part of standard of care. So, for example, there are a lot of tests that we order that you can order through a conventional lab, and red blood cell magnesium is one of them, and it's not an esoteric test. So why do we want to measure red blood cell magnesium and not serum magnesium? Because magnesium is found, its action is intracellular and intramitochondrial. And so if you measure the serum magnesium, you don't have a very good idea of the magnesium status of your patient because the magnesium is hanging out inside the cell. And so that's a reason that I order red blood cell magnesium instead of serum magnesium. So you want to know something about physiology when you make these decisions. There are a lot of clinicians that order red blood cell levels of all minerals. And I don't always do that. There are some minerals where we know what the normal is of the serum level, and we don't know what the normal is of the red blood cell level, really. So I feel that magnesium is such an important mineral. It does get depleted by chemotherapy and surgery and stress, and it's so important to every cell and all cell functions and to particularly the mitochondria. And some chemotherapy agents make the nephron leak magnesium, like all the platinum drugs. And so I want to stay as accurate with my magnesium as possible. And I think we need to do, I'm building some more modules for the course. One of them is going to be on blood tests, and one of them is going to be on side effects management, because there's so many questions of that, about that. And I'm also going to build out more talking about diet and cancer. So I'm going to leave the answer there for the moment so I get to your other questions, Judy, so bear with me for a moment. Your next question is, do you use Scutellaria bicolensis and Bicalin differently? So Scutellaria bicolensis is one of the most widely used herbs in the Chinese materia medica in the cancer setting. It's super anti-inflammatory and there acts in a lot of pathways that inhibit proliferation. And it's in almost every formula that I make for my patients. It's a real multitasker. And if you're new to the course, there's a section that discusses this. Bicalin is a polyphenol that is a phytochemical in that plant. And it is not available as an isolate. And so we don't have it to use, to my knowledge. So we use the whole plant or the whole plant extract, Judy. So if there is a time where we could get Bicalin or Bicalin, the other polyphenol, or Wogonin, which is another phytochemical in this plant, if we had them as isolates, we might use them pharmacologically in the way that we use resveratrol or curcumin as isolates, and thereby can administer a higher dose of an active principle to our patients, but it's just not available, so the answer is no. But there are companies that are making isolates. Daniel Weber's company, Panaxia, P-A-N-A-X-E-A, has very high-quality herbal products, and he makes a number of isolates. One of his products is tanchinones and tansins from red sage, dunshan, salvia miltiriza. So I use that as an isolate, but Bicalin is not available to my knowledge as an isolate. But if it was, I probably would use it. We'd all figure out how to use it. So that's the answer to that question. The third question is, what is your opinion about 5-FU cream for basal cell carcinoma? So 5-FU, 5-fluorouracil, is a chemotherapy agent that is in the category of anti-metabolites. This particular drug inhibits an enzyme called thymidylate synthase, and it thereby keeps tumor cells from completing mitosis. So it's often also called an anti-mitotic. And so that's how it works. And so when you use a chemotherapy agent that's diluted into something you could apply as a cream to your skin, you're getting a local dose of it, which is much preferable to a systemic dose. And so as with anything, if the patient tolerates it and it works, I have no objection to them using it. I live in Southern California. There's a lot of skin cancer here, and we need to be able to control it. There are some newer drugs for topical use for basal and squamous cell skin carcinomas that are immunotherapies. And they're just really expensive, and a lot of insurance companies don't cover them. But I would much prefer that because they're less toxic, and they're not about cell damage, and they're about mobilizing our immunity. I prefer those, and some forward-thinking dermatologists do prescribe them, but they're not really covered by a lot of insurance companies. But if someone has the money to pay cash for them, then I prefer that if it would work on that person's self. So I think that there's not a big downside to using the 5-FU on, you know, little spots that, or even, you know, somebody's whole chest that needs to have the top layer treated. So I think it's okay. It's better than letting the cancer keep going or cutting. And so we want to always try to take control of it without the person having to have their skin cut and the areas excised, you know, with a scalpel. So there's no harm to try it. If the person tolerates it, it's a fairly local effect. Okay. The last question is, I remember you talking about DNA damage and how it can be 10 to 20 years before you get a diagnosis, though the damage has been occurring for that long. How long does it take to repair? I'm thinking about a potential new cancer diagnosis of a long-term patient. The patient's maintained a good diet, lots of veggies, some good protein, healthy fats, done biannual liver detoxes for over 10 years, and has cleared up a lot of metabolic syndrome originally from a high-carb diet. The patient's not terribly stressed, gets enough sleep. Is there any way to get a sense of when you might think DNA damage has actually been reversed? So, the etiology of cancer is when DNA is damaged and doesn't repair, and then the cell becomes aberrant and then replicates, and then those cells replicate, and then you have, you know, a little mass the size of 3 millimeters, the size of the head of a pin, and you have a billion cells. So the timeline between the first damage to the DNA that the cell didn't repair, and there are mechanisms like P53 that and caspases and signaling for apoptosis and autophagy, where the cell recognizes it's not a healthy normal cell and self-destructs. So the art of repairing DNA doesn't change a cancer cell into not a cancer cell. Because by the time a cancer cell's developed many traits besides its altered DNA. So I don't think so much about DNA repair as preventing DNA damage and supporting the normal healthy function of DNA repair. So for example, we have lots of herbs that support a healthy P53 function, like astragalus being one of those. And that's one of the main Chinese herbs that's used as an immune modulator in the cancer setting, and also to support normal immunity. And it's also very rich in polysaccharides, and it has a lot of immune supportive functions. And so your question, how long does it take to repair? So those cells aren't going to repair. So we have to either contain them or eradicate them. And when you have tumor burden, your job is to either get rid of that tumor burden or decrease it to a level where we could manage it botanically and nutraceutically. I think the idea of DNA repair, you know, comes more from energetic medicine, and I'm not saying it's not possible. But on a pure cell biology molecular basis, the cell will repair itself or go through apoptosis or autophagy. And if it doesn't, then it becomes an aberrant cell that replicates and replicates and replicates. So you're not talking about repairing one cell by the time you have a mass or a lesion. You're talking about billions of cells. So you have to take control of those cells, basically. So I will stop there and let you ask questions about that if I didn't really answer your question.
That was great. Thank you. Question on the 5-FU. If the person were to go that course, would you expect any side effects, any of the terrain to be systemically affected, even though it's a topical diluted? And in which case, what would you then prescribe for that pathway?
So let's think about what we want to happen, okay? So we want to put this agent on top of a, you know, basal or squamous cell carcinoma lesion that isn't very deep, because if it was, the doctor would use a scalpel. But if it's not very deep, the doctor's going to try and go layer by layer and by layer and try and destroy it from the top down. And so we would expect an inflammatory response, but it's typically local. Now, I will just say, with the immunotherapy topical creams, if you apply it to a tiny area, then you don't get a systemic response. But if, say, the dermatologist had the patient apply it to their whole upper chest, because they'd spent their whole life at the beach, And although some definite lesions were visible, the dermatologist knows there's plenty of damaged tissue there. So with an immunotherapy drug that isn't damaging, You can put the cream over the whole upper chest on a patient like that, say they were a lifeguard or something, and let the inflammatory reaction of immune mobilization happen. But when you do a big area like that, you could get a systemic elevation in cytokines. With a tiny spot of 5-FU, you would not expect to have. It's really a local effect for the most part. Think about if you got a chemical burn on your skin from something you were working with, from a hobby or something, then you don't get a big systemic effect from that being on top of your skin. You get a local effect. So the way it's used is in, you know, tolerable doses over time, usually then take a break, then do another cycle, take a break, do another cycle, and till every layer is taken care of. So it also depends on the tolerance of the patients. Some people are more inflammatory than others. And so we don't want to dial down the inflammation because it's part of the response of mobilizing the immune system. So let the patient be somewhat inflamed while the therapeutic activity of the topical is happening, and then when they take their break, you know, then give them a bunch of anti-inflammatories. Great. You could also, as an acupuncturist, you know, you can do, let's say it's on their forearm, you know, you can do points proximal and distal to the area and just run some tea through there and make sure they have good immunity and healing capacity happening.
Mm-hmm. Great.
You could do skin points, you know, do large intestine 4, spleen 10, large intestine 11, maybe those points. Do the apex of the ear, which is for skin inflammation. Spleen 10 takes heat out of the skin. So you can do that to just help it along, you know, not disrupt the action. Remember, when we're using chemotherapy, whether it's intravenous, oral, or topical, we don't want to interfere with the action of the chemotherapy. We want to support it and then help the patient recover from the adverse effects of it. So it depends how it's being dosed. So a lot of those topicals are 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. So it's uncomfortable for the patient, but only a little bit, you know, only the small area. All right. Well, we're just about out of time here. Does anybody else have anything they want to ask or share? All right. Well, welcome everyone who's new to our community. We've reached the end of our time for today. I'm going to thank you for your participation. Remember, you can submit your questions and case studies in advance. And when you log into the course, just go to the Ground Rounds page. And that's where you do it. There's also a function of being able to attach any medical records documents, but it's better if you summarize them for me on the main part of the form. And that way I'll see everything all together in an organized fashion. So our next call is scheduled not for the second Tuesday of the month, because that is Valentine's Day. So we're going to do it on the following week, rather Wednesday, not Tuesday, the 21st, Wednesday the 21st. And so you can all do whatever sweet things you want to do for Valentine's Day. And so until then, let us know if we can be of support to you. And as you continue through the course, I'd love to have feedback. Tell me what you think is confusing or missing or what you'd like to see, because that helps me to make the course better for all of you. Thank you, everyone. Good night.